Welcome everybody to the second lecture in this series on Hinduism. I'm sorry I don't have enough handouts to go around at the moment. But if you could share one or two for now. I'm afraid the photocopier gave up on me just before I started. Now today's session is called The Veda and the Upanishads. Now, I don't think we'll have time to get onto the Upanishads as such, and I think I shall defer any comment on the Upanishads to 2 weeks' time, or perhaps next week, and focus mainly on Vedic ritual today, which is the main focus of today's lecture. Now, the Veda, as I said last week, this is meant as an introduction to all those without any previous knowledge of Hinduism. Particularly for theology students. So if it is rather basic for those of you who know a lot, then do forgive me. The Veda is foundational to Hindu traditions, and there are a number of issues and problems generated by this group of texts. There are text historical questions, first of all, concerning the development, structure, and the intertextuality of the material, which layers are earlier, which are later, and those kinds of questions. What do the texts tell us about the societies that compose them? What can be found in later Hinduism that is present here in incipient form? And who composed them? We also have theological and philosophical questions about the claimed source of the texts, about the cosmology they represent, or they present, and about the rituals they describe, and the meaning of the stories that they tell. Now, these two approaches are in many ways quite distinct and even antithetical to each other. The text historical questions have been concerned about the past, primarily, whereas theological or philosophical questions have been concerned about what the texts say to us today, in the present. And in one sense, all texts to the theologian or philosopher are equal, regardless of chronology, because they're all texts that we can read. So in one sense, to the philosopher, all texts are equal, are equally available. So there are these two sort of approaches to the text, which are, there's a tension between them, I think, the text historical and the theological philosophical. They're not necessarily incompatible, and I think that probably the one needs the other. Now, according to tradition, the foundations of Hindu Dharma were laid down by the ancient sages, the rishis, who saw and promulgated the Vedic scriptures. Vedic tradition, or Vedism, as Histamine refers to it, has had a deep hold on Indian thought and imagination to the present, in spite of being superseded by the cult of the temple, if you want to call it that, devotional or bhakti movements. Tantric scriptures and traditions. Madeleine Biardot has traced this sort of tenacity of the Vedic tradition in the history of Hinduism, particularly in the Mahabharata, up to her fieldwork study of Potu Raja in Tamil Nadu. For Biardot, all of Hinduism is based on the model of Vedic sacrifice. So this morning I wish to examine Vedic sacrifice, introduce the texts that describe and legitimate it, namely the Vedas, and introduce interpretations and extensions of those texts. I want to, particularly the Upanishads, but I don't think we'll have time for that. So moving on to the Vedas on the handout, that's the introductory material covered, and we're now moving on to the actual texts themselves. Now, the Veda is regarded by some Hindus as a timeless revelation, which is not of human authorship, eternal and contains all knowledge, while others regard it as a revelation of God. So there's a sort of an atheist Hinduism, I'm using the word anachronistically there, but atheist traditions which claim that the Veda is eternal and has no authorship, particularly the Mimamsakas. And there's other traditions that claim that actually the author is God. Now, traditionally, the Veda was seen by the rishis who communicated it to humanity and was put together in its present form by the stage Vyasa. That's the traditional view. From the perspective of the believer, the Veda is timeless revelation. Yet from the text's historical perspective, it was compiled over a long period of time and reflects different periods and different social and religious developments. The two perspectives are not, of course, necessarily incompatible. The term text, or indeed canon, in the Indian context, implies an oral tradition passed down with meticulous care through the generations and accuracy. The priestly class of the Vedic Aryans, the Brahmins, were and continue to be the preservers of this tradition. Indeed, the Veda was not written down for some 1,000 years after its composition, and the very act of writing, it says in the Brahmana, was considered as a pollution. So if you wrote the text, that's a polluting activity. Of course, writing was for business transactions and that sort of thing. And it wasn't published as a book, actually, until Max Müller's instigation in the 19th century. So it was preserved. It's primarily an oral text preserved through the generations, which I'll be coming on to presently. Now, the word itself, Veda, means knowledge and is cognate with the English word wit, witness, German Wissen, and probably lots of other terms in Indo-European languages. And this vast body of text contains ritual formulas, poetry, explanations of ritual, and early philosophy as well. So it's a very interesting text because it describes rituals. I mean, the whole body of the text describes rituals and also reflects upon the meaning of the rituals themselves. So it's a tradition that begins to reflect upon itself within the texts themselves. So it's the beginnings of a Hindu reflection, if you like, upon the tradition itself. Now, this Vedic corpus is intimately concerned with ritual, or sacrifice particularly, and the primary purpose of the text seems to be a ritual purpose. One of the primary distinctions that the Vedic tradition has made for its own scriptures is between mantra, the verses used in ritual that make up the collection of texts of Sanhitas, and the Brahmanas, the texts of ritual exegesis. Now, the structure of the text, or the text, the term Veda itself is used in two senses. Firstly, as a synonym for revelation, or shruti, that which is heard, in the medieval period, that which has been heard by the sages. And secondly, in a more restricted sense, it refers to the earliest layers of Vedic literature. So you've got these two senses. In one sense, it refers to the whole group of texts and becomes identified with revelation, shruti, in the medieval period, but it also refers just to the first layer of text, the Sanhitas. So on the diagram there, I've got on the handout, I've got a quick diagram to show you these. So sometimes a whole lot, all the Sanhitas, the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, and the Upanishads are all referred to as the Veda. Sometimes it refers just to the first four Sanhitas. So you could say that the Veda comprises four main traditions, the Rig, the Yajur, the Sama, and the Atharva, which are divided into three or four categories of texts. The Sanhitas, which are the earliest texts, the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, and Upanishads. The Brahmanas are theological, commentary upon ritual. The Aranyakas are wilderness texts, and the Upanishads are the secret philosophy, if you like, the secret interpretation of the Veda, internalization of the text. Now, a further group of sutra literature is sometimes added to this scheme, although this group is not part of the primary revelation, but is classified as secondary revelation, or smriti, that which is remembered, or tradition, which includes other post-Upanishadic texts, such as the law books. So that's the sort of the structure. The Rig Veda, then, is a collection, a Sanhita, a collection of 10 books called mandalas, mandala means circle, 10 circles or wheels of texts, of over 1,000 hymns, 1,028 hymns, to various gods, composed in Vedic Sanskrit, from as early as about 1200 BC, or BCE. over a period of several hundred years. It was proposed, the earliest is probably about 1200 BC, although this is contentious as well as obviously present. The Sama Veda is a book of songs based on the Rig Veda with instructions for their recitation. And the Yajur Veda is a collection of short prose formulae used in ritual, of which there are two recensions called the black and the white. And the black, the Krishna Yajurveda, comprises verse and prose, and the white comprises only mantras, only formulas. The Atharva Veda is somewhat outside of this group and is a collection of magical formula compiled around 900 BC. Though some of the material may go back to the Rig Veda. And this has traditionally been considered to be inferior to the other three Samhitas. The texts were learned by heart and sent through the generations in different branches of family lineages, these shakas, these branches of family lineage. Thus the Rig Veda was transmitted by the Sakalya branch or ascension, while others, such as the Bhaskala ascension, have been lost. Now, the transmission of these texts is quite remarkable. It's been orally transmitted with little change for 3,000 years, and Witzel says it's like this. It's like when you hear the Veda recited, it's like listening to a 3,000-year-old tape recording, because it hasn't changed in all of that period. And this inaccuracy was enabled by a system of double checking. And this is called the continuous recitation, the Samhita Parka, in which the Sanskrit rules of Sandhi, the word combination, are operative. And then a second recitation of the text without Sandhi, without the rules of euphonic combination. Sanskrit, there are rules by which when one word meets another word, it can change the endings and the beginnings of the words, so they're sometimes merged together or there is some modification. And this is Sandhi. You get it in Welsh. So eggs and bacon, you get it in English as well, to some extent. but it was a fine art in Sanskrit. And anyway, so there are two. It's learned twice. Once with Sandhi and once without, and this allows a kind of double checking process to make sure that the words are correct. So for example, in the text you've got before you, the immortal goddess has pervaded the wide space, the depths and the heights. So that phrase from the Rig Veda, which is quoted by Fritz Stahl in his Rule Without Meaning, is learned twice in the continuous flow. And in the word-for-word recitation, uru apra amartya, and so on. And this is still learned today, particularly in Kerala. The Nambudri Brahmins preserve these texts. And I think there's another tradition in the north of India. I can't remember. I think Bengal. Perhaps someone could let me know about that. In which there's a similar recitation, but there are slight changes in the text, but more or less there's a great agreement in the two different versions, which indicates that the texts are indeed very ancient. Okay, dating the texts. The earliest texts of the Rig Veda were contemporary with Mitanni texts of northern Syria and Iraq. And that culture, Mitanni culture, is from about 1450 to 1350, something like that. So some of the earliest texts are probably contemporary with that culture. And these Mitanni texts mention the gods found in the Veda, such as Varuna, Mitra, Indra, and Indra. And these texts predate the Rig Veda. These Iranian Syriac texts predate the Rig Veda. But there's no absolute dating, although we can say that the use of iron is recorded in a post-Rigvedic text, the Atharva Veda, at 1200 to 1000 BC, and they predate the Buddha, whose date is now about 400 BC. He died about 400 BC. although some Upanishads are arguably post-Buddhist. They also predate the grammatical commentary by Patanjali on his predecessor's work Panini, and Patanjali is about 150 BC. So you've got these Middle Eastern texts which mention gods found in the Veda, and then the Rig Veda is slightly later than those texts, according to Vincent's dating. Now, this is a highly, as I mentioned last week, this is a highly politicized topic, because many would wish to claim that the Veda goes back much, much further to, 5000 BC or something, or even much earlier. But the text historical evidence, as far as we know from, as done by scholars such as Witzel, indicates a date of about 1200 BC for the earliest text of Rigveda. Now, the Rigveda is the oldest text in this body of literature in an archaic stylized Sanskrit. It contains verses of praise to the Hindu gods and to early chiefs. And most of the hymns were intended to be recited during the annual Soma ritual, celebrated at the new year. It was composed before the use of iron and over a period of four or five generations under the Puru and Bharata chieftains, especially the great Bharata king Sudas. The hymns were composed by various clans or poets whose names we know, through later tradition, and through their names being interwoven into the poetry they composed. So they composed the poems and inserted their names into the poems that they composed. Now, the tradition maintains that these rishis weren't the composers of the text, but they were inspired. They were the seers, those who saw the text and transmitted it to the human community. Although they still put their names in there. Now, central to the Rig Veda is the power of speech, Vaj, which expresses Rita. Rita is cosmic harmony or cosmic order, and is the forerunner of Dharma. The vital power of Rita keeps the world and the human order functioning correctly. So in contrast to Rita, Niriti is the disappearance of or the destruction of truth. So if Rita is truth, Niriti, and there's a goddess called Niriti in the Rig Veda, is the destruction of truth. Expressing Rita in words is facilitated through Brahman, through the power that allows its formulation. So Brahman in these texts is a power or a force which allows the articulation of Rita through the Veda. And this power of correctly stated truth is found in later traditions as well. So for those of you who've read Nala, he's Satya Kriya's truth speaking, which is a kind of power related to this tradition of stating the truth. So your word is your power. The word that you speak is your act of truth and your power. And this is a common trope in other Indo-European cultures as well. Now, most of the hymns are connected with sacrifice, although some are simply poetry, some mythology, and some proto-philosophical or cosmological speculation, such as the Purusha Sukta, the hymn to the cosmic person, the giant cosmic person, who is sacrificed and from whose body the universe emerges, and also society. So the Brahmins come from his mouth, the warriors from his shoulders, the commoners from his thighs, the support of society, and the serfs from his feet. But also the whole cosmos comes from his body. And this is very similar to Scandinavian mythological traditions, such as Ymir, the giant Ymir. And they probably go back to a common ancestor. But above all, it's ritual in this text that is important, and the hymns are recited in a ritual context. The central religious practice of the Vedic Aryans was sacrifice and the sharing of the sacrificial meal with each other and with the gods, with the devas. Through sacrifice, the gods are appeased, favours such as sons and cattle are won, and the social standing of the sacrificer, the person instigating the rite, is elevated. Stephanie Jamieson, who writes very eloquently on Vedic traditions, has observed that Vedic ritual is the ideally portable religion. She calls it the ideally portable religion, requiring no fixed places of worship, no images of texts to be carried, no images or texts to be carried around. The texts are learned by heart, and you can set up a Vedic ritual in a short period of time. The term sacrifice, homa or yajna, refers not only to animal sacrifice, but to any offering into the fire, such as milk or clarified butter, curds, grains, and the spavol, the soma plant, which I'll be talking about presently, as well as domestic animals, goats, cattle, sheep, and horses. And the fire links this world to the divine realm. So sacrifice is central. Now, two kinds of ritual were developed, called the Shrauta, or solemn rites, and the domestic rites. The earliest rites, the Shrauta, the solemn rites, and the Griya, the domestic rites, are later developments. Now, our knowledge of these rites comes mainly from much later Shrauta sutras, but we can assume that some form of Shrauta observance reaches back to the Rig Veda itself, as the text refers to various kinds of priests involved in the rite, particularly four kinds of priests. It gives an account of the horse sacrifice, and it gives an account of the soma sacrifice. The Shrauta rites are still performed, particularly by the Nambudri Brahmins in Kerala, which was studied by Fritz Stahl, and seem to have remained intact from at least the time of the Shrauta text to the present day, which is a remarkable cultural phenomenon, a ritual continuity that needs to be emphasised. Now, the sacrificial animal was originally tied to a sacrificing pole and decapitated, although later it was suffocated outside of the ritual enclosure. But the most important ritual seems to be the preparation and offering of a sacred drink, soma. This was prepared from an unknown plant through various pressings. It was pressed and a substance produced, which was then drunk by the yajamana, by the instigator of the sacrifice, and by the priests. And soma seems to be a substitute, according to Witzel, of an Indo-Aryan sacred drink made from fermented honey or mead. And you think of the Beaka people, a Neolithic Beaka people, perhaps the Beakas that they're always buried with actually were from some Indo-European drink that they would drink for religious festival. I don't know, it just occurred to me last night. It's also found in Zoroastrianism tradition where it's called Hyoma. Now, soma is a plant, it's a drink, and it's a god. All of those three things. And it's the most important god in the Rig Veda. There's a whole book devoted to soma. And it's the most mentioned god, along with Indra. Indra is the... I think soma might occur just a bit more times than Indra. But certainly there's a whole book devoted to soma. And there was some controversy some years ago as to what this was. There was... Gordon Wasson was a wonderful... He was a banker or something who had an interest in mushrooms because he was married to a Russian mycologist, and he also had an interest in Sanskrit, and he started to study the Rig Veda and argued that soma in the Rig Veda was actually a hallucinogenic mushroom, the fly agaric mushroom, and he did various experiments pressing it. And there's a wonderful book called The Divine Mushroom of Immortality, in which he shows photographs of the pressing process of what the liquid looks like. and sets beside it descriptions in the Rig Veda of the solar cloud. And it's very interesting. It's almost convincing, but not quite convincing, because it's the latest evidence seems to think that solar was something called a phaedra, which was another word for a sea grape, which is not a hallucinogenic substance at all, but a stimulant. So they would, warriors would take a phaedra when they went into battle. It's like an amphetamine substance. And they think they know this now, because they found in Iran, where Zoroastrianism developed, where they have Homa rituals, are cognate with the Soma rituals of the Vedic Aryans, they found pots with ephedra in them, in the bottom of them. So the latest thinking is that Soma was actually ephedra. But as the Aryan cultures moved across northern India, they lost the source of Soma, and so they began to have Soma substitutes, which were different kinds of plants and vines pressed instead of the original Soma plant, which is the identity of which is lost. So there are various possibilities. One of the most likely being that it's this amphetamine drink from the sea grape or ephedra, from which ephedrine comes, of course. There's asthmatics amongst us. Now the horse sacrifice also is referred to in the rites, and itself an old Indo-European rite. So there are Irish texts which refer to a horse sacrifice, in which the king's wife, would symbolically spend the night with the dead stallion, which is exactly cognate, exactly related to the Ashvamedha, where the horse is sacrificed and the king's wife symbolically sleeps with the stallion, and the power of the sacrifice goes into the queen, into the king, and from the king into the people. So there's this process of power is transmitted through this rite. And this seems to be cognate with other Indo-European traditions, and is certainly found in Ireland, in pre-Christian Ireland. So you've got these different deities in the Veda. You've got hymns to the gods, the most important god being Soma. You've got the gods classified into three realms, the earth, the atmosphere, and the sky. Varuna, for example, is in the sky. Now, in the middle realm, the gods of the atmosphere, two gods are particularly important, Soma and Agni. And they're the transition or the mediation between the human world and the divine world, but they're also deities in themselves. Now, the Shatra rites that I want to focus on are the earliest that we have record of in the world. The earliest ritual description, as far as I know, in the world. And these were also the most complex and elaborate of rites, which tied in ritual performance with language. So it's interesting that the earliest rituals are the most complex, and it gets simpler after that, as indeed does language. The sacrifice was believed to have existed from all eternity, and even the creation of the cosmos itself was regarded as a sacrifice in the Purusha Sukta of the Rig Veda at 1090. And the Vedas express a number of ideas about sacrifice, which I've got written here. First of all, sacrifice is performed to produce results. Propitiation of a god, or prosperity in this world and the next. Or to keep a god away. Some gods, like Rudra, you don't want to take your children and your cattle, you want to keep them away, you want to appease them. There's also the idea in the Brahmanas that the existence of the universe itself depends upon the sacrifice. You perform sacrifice to keep the universe going so the sun will rise tomorrow. The second idea, the power of the sacrifice came to be understood as being greater than the gods. The power of the sacrifice is Brahman. Brahman became conceptualized as being greater than the gods. And this theme particularly develops in the Upanishads. And as you know, in later Hinduism, it's very important. It becomes the absolute sustaining power of the universe. And it is the power which connects the sacrifice to the cosmic order, Rita. So the sacrifice is connected to the cosmic order through the power of through the power which is Brahman. Brahman is the power which does that. Thirdly, sacrifice is identified with heat, tapas, which is later became identified with the heat of asceticism. So yogis perform asceticism and produce tapas, produce heat. So heat, tapas, is the origin of the cosmos on this account. And it's the power of living forms, the power of Indra, and the power of the ascetics and the yogis. There are indications, as we'll see next time, of early asceticism in the Veda, in the Rig Veda, and in the Vedic texts generally. Fourthly, the sacrifice is performed by priests on behalf of a householder called the sacrificer, the Yajamana, who is accompanied by his wife. And the sacrificial victim is a symbol of the sacrificer. The sacrificial victim is a substitute for the sacrificer himself. So instead of offering yourself to the deity, you offer an animal instead, or a soma plant. And the sacrificer is purified and symbolically reborn in the rite of diksha before the sacrifice itself. Fifthly, the sacrifice is key in the symbolic universe of the Veda and in the categories that form the Vedic Aryan world. Put crudely, we might say that there are three realms, the pure, the everyday, or the profane, and the sacred, with different social and cultural phenomena attached to each of these. So in a diagram, which I think is in the handout there, I've just listed those three. So you've got animal categories, human categories, and geographical categories. This is derived from a number of sources, Bruce Lincoln's book on myth and cosmos, and Brian Wilson. So animal categories, you've got wild animals, and then in the everyday or profane category you've got domestic animals, and then the sacred category you've got sacred sacrificial animals and such as horses. You also get a dog sacrifice somewhere in the Rig Veda, which is an impure kind of sacrifice, something a bad sacrifice. So there are animals. There's an I'll have to check that out, so I just don't remember off the top of my head. But anyway, so you've got sacrificial animals, a category, separate category for them. You've got human categories, and in the impure category are non-Aryans, mlechas, those who are outside of the Aryan fold, and outcasts. And in the worldly category, you've got the kshatriyas and probably the vaishyas. And the sacred category, you've got the Brahmins, the voice of the tradition. And this is also divided. Geographical categories are related to this. The tribal lands are impure, the lands outside of the Aryan realm. Then you get the Aryavarta, the land of the Aryans, and then you've got the area of the sacrifice, which later becomes the area of the temple as the sacred area. And Bruce Lincoln, in his early book about 20 years ago now, summarizes the principles of these systems. He says, man and cosmos are homologous. There's a connection between human beings and the cosmos. He uses the word man 20 years ago, humanity. Humanity and cosmos are homologous. Matter is eternal, but subject to infinite recombination, which is a theme that's developed in later Hindu traditions. Time is infinite, again a common idea in Indian thinking, no beginning and no end. And change is constant, but the same processes cyclically recur. I think I've felt cyclically. Oh no, it's okay. It doesn't look right to me. Cyclically recur. Now, this is all very well, and these are kinds of correspondences between sacrifice and the universe are elaborated at length in texts called the Brahmanas. But if we pay attention to the Shrauta texts themselves, what do we find? If we look at the Shrauta rituals themselves, what do we find? Do we find any of these kinds of ideas about correspondence and so on? Now, Fritz Stahl has interestingly and provocatively claimed that we clearly find something, but we do not find meaning. When we examine the complex strata rights, what we find is a complex set of rules, the performance of ritual action accompanied by verbal sounds, but the meanings attributed to them are random and ad hoc. In themselves, the strata rites, the Vedic rites, are meaningless. They are indeed rules without meaning. They have a structure, but no semantics. And I want to examine that claim in the time that we have remaining to us. So that's Stahl's claim. I mean, certainly the Brahmanists think that the ritual has meaning and tries to find meaning. And indeed the Upanishads do. So the horse sacrifice, in the opening of the Brihadaranyaka, we get the meaning of the horse sacrifice. The horse's head is the dawn, and other parts of the body are different parts of the cosmos. And certainly later commentators argue that it has meaning. So the Upanishads argue that the real meaning of the sacrifice is the sacrifice of the lower self to the cosmic, the absolute self, the Atman to the Brahman, the internalization of the, and the fire is, it means the internalization of the fire in the breath. So certainly the tradition interprets the rituals in particular in semantic ways as having meaning. And anthropologists and Indologists have argued that the Vedic rituals are meaningful. But Stahl claims that if you look at the Vedic ritual itself, it has rules without meaning. It is actually not meaningful. So, for example, the simplest strata rite is called the Agnihotra, the sacrifice of Agni, or to Agni. And it consists of an oblation of milk offered every morning and evening by a householder with the optional assistance of a priest. So you offer milk into the flames, into the fire. But many strata performances entail complex operations with as many as 17 priests. So you've got this basic structure of which pervades later Hinduism, I think. You've got making an offering and into the fire and arguably receiving a blessing in return. And that's the most simple then, the Agnihotra. Now the most elaborate was called the Agnichayana. Agnichayana means the piling up of Agni, and it involved the piling up of bricks in a bird-shaped altar. Each brick falling into a specific group and deposited in a specific order, accompanied by a specific mantra. I was going to bring along a diagram, but I'm afraid I've been put behind. So this is a crude drawing. So that's the bird-shaped altar, which is built up of bricks, of layers of bricks. It looks in the shape of a giant bird. And you've got the three fires over here. And the Veda goes into great detail about how this altar is constructed. So each layer of bricks is accompanied by certain mantras. It's a chayana, piling up of the fire of the altar. And this chayana is also related to the Buddhist chaitya, or a stupa, where the relics for the Buddha, and also chitti, pyre, funeral pyre. So over the 12 days of the rite, of the Agnichayana rite, there are various stages. Among the ritual sequences are the Ishti and Soma sequence. Now, what's interesting is the Soma sequence of rites. The Agnichayana comprises 12 Soma sequences, each sequence comprising a chant, a stotra, from the Sama Veda, a recitation, shastra, from the Rig Veda, Soma offerings to the deities, and the Soma drinking by the Yajamana, by the sacrificer, and some priests. Now, one of the striking features about the Soma rite is a process of surrounding or embedding. So the construction of each layer on the fire altar, each layer of brick, is surrounded by performances called pravargya, the preliminary rites to the Soma sacrifice, and upasag, the ending rites. So you get a pattern, which I've got in the sheet there, the surrounding or bedding. So you get the pravargya, upasag, the layer of bricks, pravargya, upasag pattern. And you also get a second pattern, pravargya, upasad, Leia Upasad Pravargya. Now, in this process, Pravargya and Upasad are regarded as one unit. For if there were two units, we'd have that second pattern. So in the first pattern, in A, you've got Pravargya and Upasad regarded as one unit. So you get that process, Pravargya, Upasad, then you get the layer of bricks put there, and then Pravargya, Upasad writes following it. In the second pattern, you get Pravargya and Upasad regarded as two distinct processes. So you get Pravargya, Upasad, then the layer of bricks followed by Upasad, followed by Pravargya. So that Upasad layer Pravargya is embedded or surrounded by two Pravargya writes. Now that latter pattern does occur and is much more common than the former. Now this structure is also found in recitation. Thus, at the end of each consecration of a layer of the altar, the Advarayu priest, one of the four priests involved, recites one of the Sanghitas, followed by a different verse from the same Sanghita. So you get this recitation of these two texts. Now, if the recitation of both together is B, Stahl says, if we call the recitation of both together B, and the intervening recitations A, we get the structure BAB. Now, this explains or accounts for the structure Pravargya Upasad Leya Pravargya Upasad. And it accounts for the second Pravargya Upasad Leya Upasad Pravargya if applied twice, interpreting B first as Upasad and then as Pravargya. So that's the basic pattern of the Shastra rituals. Then Stahl argues and indeed tries to demonstrate. A BAB is a recursive structure. Now this BAB is a recursive structure in the rites. It's found throughout Vedic ritual. So if Easterman says, well, a common pattern is offerings of rice, and then you get an interval, and then offerings of rice again. So that's Easterman hasn't articulated it in these terms, but certainly Easterman is aware of this embedding structure, this embedding process. Now this structure becomes extremely complex with recitations embedded within recitations and actions nested or embedded in other actions. Insertions are made of other insertions, which are governed by particular rules that Stahl claims to identify and clarify. So one rule, for example, is if you get B, then B entails ABA. So whenever you get B occurring, that means ABA. That means an embedding of this structure ABA that within it. Which in turn means, if you then interpret B to mean that, you get the structure AABAA or AAABAAA and so on, ad infinitum, possibly. So by applying the rule again and again, you get this ritual extension, which can be theoretically extended indefinitely. For example, the Satra rituals, which are described in the text, are of this nature. But they're never performed, they're only theoretical. So the text itself is aware of this possible endless replication of this pattern. Now, a concrete example given by Stahl. The animal sacrificed for Vayu, for the wind, let's call it B, is inserted into the Agni Chayana after the preparation of the Ukka pots, A, and before the election of the priests, C. And the ritual may therefore be written as when you get A and C, then that entails A, B, C. Whenever you get A and C, whenever you get the Ukka pots and the election of the priests, then you get the insertion of the sacrifice to Vayu in it. So you get the pattern A, B, C. So B, the animal sacrifice, itself has an internal structure comprising the recitation of verses, or the Samyubeni verses, E, along with the rites preceding the verses, D, and the rites following the verses, and the rites following the verses, which is again E, the Samyubeni rites. So the animal sacrifice may be represented in the following way. DEF, or if B, then DEF, where D is the preceding verses, E is the following verses. Oh no, I'm sorry, I've written it wrongly there. So you've got, yeah, the following verses are F, sorry, that's F, not E, in my handout. So you get this pattern: A, B, and C are the structure of the rites, and B, within B is embedded this process D, E, F. Okay, and that's the basic pattern. Okay. Now there are even more complex transformations, but you get the idea of rites being embedded within rites. So you get this tree-like structure that you can identify. And this is governed by certain rules. When you get this rite happening, then you have to have these two things in it. And Stahl has done, he spent many years trying to identify the rules whereby these Shraddha rituals occur. Now what we have here then, according to Stahl, is the discovery that the Vedic ritual comprises complex rules which can be specified and analysed. And it is therefore a syntactic argument. It's an argument from syntax, not from semantics. Nowhere is the meaning of the contents important in the performance, but only the correct following of the rules. Meaning that we find in the Brahmanas and Upanishads is secondary and wholly irrelevant to the procedure of the rite. Vedic ritual is therefore rules without meaning. And at the beginning of his book, Rules Without Meaning, he's got a wonderful photograph of a Nambudri Brahmin showing his son at a certain process in the rite. You put your hand on the kusha grass, one hand on the other like that. And then at a later time, you have to reverse your hands and put them on the kusha grass like that. And he explains how this is meaningless action, but it's rule-governed action. It has no meaning. There are no meanings going through the minds of the people who are doing it, he argues, but it's important that they do it correctly. So it's rule-governed behaviour, but without semantics. That's the Stahl position. I've got to hurry. Now, this is an interesting and compelling argument. The problem with it, however, seems to be the following. It seems to claim that the rituals, Shraddha rituals, are outside of history. It seems to dehumanize them in some way. It claims that they're outside of history. And it does not take into account power relations between social actors involved or the broader social context. So even if Stahl is right, you could still say, well, and so what? That's not what's important. What's important is the relationships between the social actors and the reasons for their performance, even though the actions itself are ungoverned. Now, even given that the rites are rule-governed, they are not wholly ends in themselves, because they are indices of wider social processes involving status and power. Thus, the performance of the Agni Chayana rite gives the Yajamana communal status, it elevates their status. Stahl argues that ritual is action for its own sake. It's not for. He says, well, okay, what's action? Action is for its own sake or for the sake of something else. Ritual is action for its own sake, not for the sake of something else. Like play. Play, you could argue, is action for its own sake. And ritual is like that. It's not teleological. Okay, secondly, it underestimates the importance of a violent animal sacrifice, you could argue, which, according to thinkers like René Girard, following Sylvian Levy, channels the violence of a society and so is cathartic. There's that argument, which has some force, arguably. I won't go into Girard now. Now, thirdly, the sacrifice is an expression of indigenous categorizations of the world, Vedic Aryan categorizations of the world, involving purity and impurity, and so expresses the values of the community to which it belongs. And the values of which the rite is an index exceed the action itself. So although Stahl's work is compelling and his argument is very detailed and well presented, you could argue that he's missed the fundamental point that rituals have to be seen in a wider social context and a wider context of human values, as indeed is recognised by the tradition, by the Brahmanism, and by the Upanishads. But I'll let you make up your own mind about Stahl and his understanding of ritual. And indeed, it's true, as he says, that no general theory of ritual can ignore the shrouding material. You get lots of anthropologists writing on ritual generally, but with no reference to the Indic traditions, which is, you can't possibly generate a general theory of ritual without reference to this material. So any questions or points before we wind up? It's called Rules Without Meaning. I think it's been republished as Mantras. Does anyone know?
It's here
on the back. Yeah. Rituals and Mantras is another version, but it's very well worth looking at. And there's a number of articles in Newman as well, about 15, 20 years ago now. But he hasn't modified his position. And indeed wants to extend it.
I want to make two comments.
Go on.
One is that you mentioned that there is a possibility that Vedas were composed by Vyasa. Is it conceivable? Because if you look at the four yugas, Dvapara, Dwapara, Kali, Rama lived in Treta Yuga, Krishna lived in Dwapara Yuga. So Mahabharata must have been composed at that time, and Ramayana should precede. Unless Vedas follow Ramayana and Mahabharata, it is inconceivable that Vyasa could have been the author of Vedas.
He was the editor.
Yes, that's right.
He was the editor, he was never the author.
Oh, the editor, that's right.
He's the editor. The word Vyasa actually means compiler.
The compiler, yes.
He is the editor.
But
he was the one who divided into the four groups.
Whether he did or not, I don't know. I mean, he must have been
the word
time.
Vyasa is a common word, but even though you look at it as one figure, people like Dasgupta, who's written the book on the Indian philosophy, so you have to look at it in the context that word Vyasa is used in the term of an editor, or a compiler.
So certainly they were compiled and edited, but whether it was one person or a group of people.
And again, there is no mention in what way you sort of take this with regard to the yuga.
No,
it's very important to the Hindu.
No, that comes in the Itihasa section.
Yeah,
Itihasa
yuga.
And about the Soma, even Arsi has mentioned about Soma in his work. I have a feeling perhaps today's bomb has derived from Soma.
There was some debate about that. Wasson argued
which
that it
is
wasn't.
Opium poppy.
He argued that it wasn't that. He argued it was something
I
else.
I see.
I was just looking at the complexity of all these rituals that you mentioned. If you look at individual meaning, maybe it has no. But when you look at the performance of a yajna, the whole performance is like a theatre. Each act may not have its meaning, something, but the performance itself has got a mesmerizing effect on the observer. Mm-hmm. And whether that was part of the importance was to actually mesmerize the observer into by making it complex, because the recitation of the Samaveda and the recitations of the Veda has got an effect. It's like listening to the music.
Yeah.
So any action, whether it is dance ritual, any kind of ritual,
yes,
has produces an effect.
That's what an audience,
which is,
yes,
something like the individual part. Individual parts have no meaning, but the sum of the parts has got a totally different meaning.
That's why I think Stahl is probably ultimately wrong, because in his stress on the structure, because
he's
fails
to see the big picture.
Yes,
this is just happens by the personal experience. Individual action makes no meaning.
Well, look at Stahl. I mean, he has lots of personal experience. He participated in many rites himself and set them up, but But I agree, yes, yes.
And the second point I have is that you have certain Vedic words like Om, Bhur, Bhuva, Swaha, so on, which are sounds, basically.
Yeah.
But they allude to a particular meaning.
Ah. Stahl says, like, Om, Bhur, Bhuva, that the Gayatri just fell out of the Vedas. It actually has, it's meaningless. It's randomly. I didn't go into that, but yeah.
Because even the title of Upanishad, there's a huge amount of explanation of those four words and why the meditation on those four words at different levels. You can meditate on each of those words, so it does have a meaning.
Right? Yes. Well, the tradition maintains that. Stahl maintains it, doesn't it? So I'll tell you about Stahl's view of the Gayatri next time. Yeah. Okay.